Hello everyone, welcome to Talk Black, a podcast where we talk about truth-telling, black politics. I'm on Yagara and Turrbal country in Mianjin, or so-called Brisbane. My name is Larissa Baldwin. I'm a Widjibal Wyuba woman, and I am also the First Nations Justice Campaigns Director at GetUp. Every week, we're going to give you news and stories and politics and talk about what's happening across the country, what mob are doing. We're going to have some really deadly co-hosts who are also known as my team at GetUp, the First Nations Justice team, a team of deadly campaigners. Today, we have Edie Shepherd, who's in our team.
Hello, Edie Wanyari. I'm calling in from Wurundjeri country here in Nam, or so-called Melbourne, and I'm a proud Wurundjeri and Noongar woman and a senior organiser in the First Nations Justice team, but come from a big family of political activists, both my mum and my dad. So it's pretty rad to be able to continue the legacy of activism and protest in my family through my work. And that's me.
But we're very excited today to have a really deadly guest, Mulunjali and South Sea Islander woman. She's going to come and talk about her new book, Another Day in a Colony. And we're really excited to have her, really privileged to have her as our first guest, Professor Chelsea Watergo.
I've had a race discrimination support role this morning for like 2 hours. So this is refreshing.
Chelsea, who are you? Who's your mob? Where are you from?
Oh, so many big questions. So I'm Chelsea Watergo. I used to be known as Chelsea Bond. That was my married name. I'm Mulunjali and South Sea through the Williams and Watergo families. And so I've got mob down Tweed Heads and mob up in Bowen. But we were born and raised on Yuggera country in the outer southern suburbs of Brisbane.
So you've written a book called Another Day in the Colony. Why did you write this book?
I was always troubled by the fact as an academic that much of my intellectual labour each day was spent on appealing to settlers, educating them, whether it was in Indigenous health or whether it was critical Indigenous studies. The students were predominantly non-Indigenous. I'd come home from work and my family and my community got the least of me at times. You know, it's the board meetings after hours when you've got nothing left in the tank. And I loved the work that I was doing in terms of the kind of critical conversations I was having, but it wasn't with mob. It was drawn from my experience with mob and the conversations that we have. And I wanted to engage intellectually with my own people, not as a sort of all-knowing academic, but as a black fella just making sense of this place and being in conversation with others about it.
Yeah.
And I had all these different stories that I'd been telling and experiences that I tried to make sense of. And UQP approached me to do a book.
Yeah.
So I didn't go to them. They come and hit me up. And so I thought about doing a series of essays to draw those connections that actually, we are this one body in the one world navigating all this violence in different ways, but often similar ways, and to kind of come together and think about how we're strategizing around race and racism in a way that better preserves black bodies, black families, and black communities.
One of the things you say in the book is that it's not for white fellas.
Mm-hmm. Look, they can buy it. knock yourself out. Give it to your family, the racist Auntie Mary, by all means. But, you know, they're not the intended audience. White fellas, of course, are reading it and they'll get something from it.
Yeah.
But it's not all meant for them.
Yeah.
And see, for a colonizing people, sometimes it's hard for them to understand that just because you like it doesn't mean you can take it, and not everything is meant for you.
Yeah, I resonate with this so much in the work that we do around campaigning and organising, and a lot of people ask me to come and step into spaces and, like, you know, train them about how we do campaigning better. And I was like, well, we don't campaign for white fellas. Like, do you know what I mean? We, like, if they want to come on and support us, that's great. Yep. But even in your advocacy and going out to talking to, you know, bodies that are just like, you know, experiencing this backlash from community. And I was like, well, we think about your advocacy in the way that you're talking about us. That's not how we talk about ourselves. So if your advocacy isn't first for us, then who is it for?
Yep.
I really resonate with that around the idea of, like, getting people engaged in a conversation. And it's like, well, if you're talking about someone as some alien, some other in a way that we don't see ourselves, then why would our mob engage with the work that we're doing?
And I think there's a whole lot of, even when we declare, you know, the work that we're going to do is going to be for mob first and foremost, there's always resistance to that. There's a sense of indignation, particularly for black women.
Yeah.
And I use the story of Nana Slocky, and mum talked about when, you know, even years after being out of, you know, domestic servitude, that she would ready the day with the apron on and the hair in the bun. There is this resistance against this idea that we could be of service just for each other. And we did it with our black women. You know, we had people annoyed that we were laughing, and, you know, and all this stuff because we were in conversation with each other, and you see it all the time. So it's, you know, we can declare it, but there is a fight even in trying to do that work, and you can be framed in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
Typically negative ways.
Yeah.
Or insisting on being of service to mob You know, like, and I just can't think of what better service could there be than to be of service to young people.
Yeah, one of my favourite podcasts, Wild Black Women, we had got it's got a, such a playlist of like us travelling around the country, driving for hours on end in the territory across Queensland or WA. No shade, but when we would like drive with white fellas that work with us and that sort of thing, we would be busting out laughing and they just don't get any of the references. And it's like, it's kind of fun as well, just to be like, oh, well, I don't.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because with the book too, with the publisher, I'm like, I'm not footnoting shit.
Yeah.
If they don't understand it, it's not meant for them.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And as black fellas, we grew up learning that there's stories that aren't meant for us at all or yet.
Yeah.
And we know that. And that's what the difference with relational people is we know that we can't have everything, that we're not entitled to everything. And so I had lots of interesting debates with the editors at various times with the book in terms of things like footnoting. The final stage of editing, I had a couple of happy endings I wanted to put on the chapters because things had changed and I wanted to go, well, look, I rolled that whole board of feminist law journal.
Yeah.
And look, I became professor. And I remember one of the comments was like, oh, that sounds a bit petty. And I'm like, no, this is black fellas. We deserve those happy endings too.
Yeah.
And to frame that as somehow being petty.
Yeah.
You know, I could see what was going on there as though they were not worthy of that.
I very recently finished reading the book. I was talking to my partner about this. So my partner's a white fella, we can't all be perfect. My partner was like, oh, you know, like, should I read it? And I was like, well, yeah, but it's not for you. And she was very confused. And I was thinking about it. And like, it's bleak, but not quite, of just like how fucking liberating it is to have something to consume that is for me and not for them. It doesn't exist. And it's the same thing. Like when I'm doing this work with this team, it's majority black women for black people, completely controlled and by and for us. I think that there's something really liberating about actually being able to like engage intellectually as well, because the academy in that domain is so colonial and white and like all of that kind of gross bullshit, but like to actually be able to intellectually engage with blackness and with black rage as well as black joy and hope is just, it's pretty fucking magical, hey.
But it's like even with the creative works, like I feel like a really bad Aborigine at times because there are some black movies I hate them. Don't want to watch. and because you know they're for a wide audience and you sit there feeling betrayed because you think, you know, we're going to see our stories and it's like, oh no, it's our story still presented with and those movies always feature a white woman grasping a black child. High ground, like there were just these kept going to these shots of Nicole Kidman holding this kid.
I can't watch it.
And old mate, and it didn't make sense even in that, but it was just they know no other way to tell the story that doesn't position them as the saviours, as innocent, benevolent, virtuous. And we've got to watch like this massacre and then be reminded that the white man who was a party to that massacre is the hero. Like,
yeah,
that it's not just they penetrate a white audience, but they construct the white characters in a way that just tells such a lie about even a massacre, you know?
Yeah, I think mob that I work with really trust me with their stories and they trust me to take them out into the mainstream media, into different media platforms.
And you've
earned
that trust. And yeah, it's handed to you. Yeah. Like you've got to.
But there's 100%. Like there's a lot of work. But it's also about like, you know, if a journalist is going to talk down to mob, and I'll have a go at them and just be like, you're not entitled to our stories and that's not how you're going to speak to people that, you know, whether they're coming in from Bush or like, you know, just talking like blackfellas and that sort of stuff. We had this one time where we protested in Parliament and occupied the Parliament foyer, and there was all these reporters hanging around and they were just like trying to ask all these questions. But it's also part of that is like not performing our trauma. Mm-hmm. And so I remember just like this woman just jumped in from Sky News and was like, tell me about, you know, basically about alcoholism in our communities. And there had been this mob that had travelled down from the NT and they just were just like, eyes rolling, I just jumped in front of the camera like, you're not entitled to our stories, you're not asking any more questions, go away, like,
bye.
But one of the things you talk about in the book and would be good to unpack is around our relationship, and you say that we haven't had our post-colonial moment and our relationship with the settler colonial state. What does that mean?
Settler colonialism is a form of colonialism, of course, and it's one where the settlers never go back to the mother country.
Yeah.
They stay. And so I don't know how you have a post-colonial moment in a settler colonial state.
Yeah.
And you only have to look in the brief 200-plus years of our history, the relationship is the same.
Yeah.
There's different articulations of it, but, you know, I mean, even in, you know, post 2000, we're met with a new paternalism in Indigenous affairs. A new paternalism.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what's post-colonial about a new paternalism?
It's a new paternalism and this idea that I think has been sold to people that, you know, we will be more palatable if our structures and our organisations and our advocacy looks more like government. Oh, it didn't work. It doesn't work for us.
And it's the whole thing that, you know, that so indigeneity from the get-go is you know, framed as a problem and a problem to be solved. And, you know, and they did their best to physically eradicate us and sorry, but still here.
Yeah, still here.
Still here. But I'm interested in psychologically the violence of settler colonialism in how it makes us think about ourselves and our existence. And unfortunately, we have a lot of mob who subscribe to the idea that we are the problem.
Yeah.
And that closing the gap is some sort of emancipatory agenda that if we just become like white people.
I would like to rip that message.
But even the first of her tribe type celebrations that we're met with all the time.
Yeah. You know,
the first of this to do that. Our worth as a people apparently is our ability to get in proximity to white institutions.
Yeah.
Like it sounds a little bit assimilatory, I think.
Yeah.
That we become more like white people and suddenly, and that's what we should be applauding. And that's part of the reason of writing the book was I wanted to speak to this generation post 2000 who didn't see Cathy Freeman run with the Aboriginal flag the first time.
Yeah.
Who didn't see Yothu Yindu on Rage on a Saturday morning, who don't have any memory of ATSIC and the vibrant community-controlled sector that our communities once had where we ran things, at least some things, who don't have a sense of any sense of that. And it was, look, it wasn't self-determination in its fullest sense, of course, but compared to what we're in now, those that haven't got experience of the 80s and 90s of and how blackfellas are playing internationally, politically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why ATSIC was abolished because of its
too much.
And it was having too much power. And they said it, the pendulum had swung too far.
Yeah.
And so we've had 20 years of this new paternalism.
Someone rang me the other day, well, a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about, you know, there's all these yarns about, you know, representative bodies and that a white person, well, we were nameless, and they were just like, you know, I had this really good idea. What if there was a body where every piece of policy went through and we had, you know, and there was like regions and they could give feedback? And I was like, yeah, we had that.
Yeah. And
John Howard abolished it. It was called ATSIC and it was kind of too good. One of the things I think that's really shaped my politic and where I'm at is that I started an organisation called the SEED, Indigenous Youth Like Climate Network. Mm-mm. And this is the generation of people that you're talking about that are kind of, they're younger, they didn't know what ATSIC was, they weren't around for that. And I was talking about it a few weeks ago and how, like, I feel very protective of the journey through identity in this, like, colonial settler state that young people go through because it's very antagonistic and hostile and it's a really hard journey to take and all blackfellas go through it. And, you know, this idea that originally when we, you know, were in the movement of the climate and conservation movement and conservation is land without people and that sort of stuff. And originally when we started and established Seed Mob, we would, you know, goodwill trying to educate these people. And there's a point where you're just like, you know what we're talking about. Like,
it's not about coming up with a new manual or guide because we produced enough of those or some cultural awareness training.
Yeah, and so we went through this thing of like, well, who are we in this space and what are we giving to people? And this idea of being protective around who we show up for and what is it for? Because it's like, it's not worth burning young people because they would go on this thing of like, you know, the evolution of Seed Mom giving speeches to people would be like all in the beginning, very like lovely, welcoming. This is who I am and it's so green and it's just like really, it's beautiful. But then they go through like learning, being with each other, getting angry about these people not doing the things that they're asking for and they're asking really nicely. And then it turns into these fights about like colonization and then you have the moment where they're just like, oh no, these young mob too angry to get up on these stages now because they're just like, no, railing at them, you know what I mean?
But I think it's also about the power of black collectives and that's certainly shaped my work going forward now in terms of like I'm not going to, you know, sit in classrooms full of settlers teaching them about my culture. I'm really interested in building black collectives because we're seeing in this moment the continued dispersal of the natives.
Yeah.
We're seeing across urban indigenous communities of mob being pushed further out and spread out. We don't, you know, even in Nala, like our indigenous population is on the decline because it's getting harder to, you know, less affordable to even live in places like the historical black communities. And so the dispersal of black communities in this time, unlike previous generations where mob grew up in really close-knit Black communities.
Yeah.
And then in the institutions, we've seen in the academy the doing away of Indigenous academic units and dispersing the scholars across the institution. There's a strategy here in disbanding the natives so that we don't collude and collaborate. And our response must be to build Black collectives. And when we come together, the power, the strength that it's drawn from that, the experience, the learning, that's the stuff I'm really excited about, is that in the midst of the ongoing war and how exhausting it may be, there is so much joy to be found in these Black collectives wherever we build them, you know, whether it's just a reading group, whether it's a Black group chat. And that's what we have to do now, is rebuild community and collectives for each other, for ourselves, and to strategize and come together. And that's the problem with the first of her tribe types and this, you know, the individual Aborigine, the statistical Aborigine. It's about the individual and not about our advancement as a people.
Yeah. This concept of fuck hope.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are a little bit like, what are you talking about? Like, how dare you say that?
I had a fight with Professor Patricia Hill Collins on a train in Sydney after the Crawser conference, because she just was so shocked that I would be abandoning hope. Okay, where do I start? What do you want to know about it? Well, where did it come from?
Where did it come from?
I think it's a lot like the journey you just described with them kids, right? I mean, I came to it, I guess, through my own journey of learning. And, you know, I grew up in a household in the 80s with, you know, white mother, Black father. And he grew up in a time where there wasn't illegal to discriminate on the grounds of race.
Yeah.
So his strategy for surviving racism was to, you know, turn the other cheek, rise above it. And for us kids, it was to be 10 times better.
Yeah.
Just to break even.
Ten times more work.
And we could do it, and because we never had this sense of inferiority, either being Black or poor growing up. I didn't know it was a problem.
Yeah.
I studied Indigenous health and I was like, oh, shit, we're like really problematic. But in our home, that was not the thinking. We were to be better then because we were.
Yeah.
And we just believe that. That's why I'm sort of hyperproductive at times, because had to like work. And even meeting all of their standards of excellence and surpassing them, at the end of the day, it didn't fucking matter.
No.
You know, they can suspend at any time your membership to their institutions, and there's no escaping the racialized location that we're in. There's no transcending race. And I think some of us have grown up on, or certainly I was, the movies from the US, the civil rights movies, Mississippi Burning, and the ending, there's always the court verdict and there's the win that gives us hope. And I was fed a diet of that growing up.
Yeah.
And certainly in the 80s and 90s, there was a sense of hope in Indigenous affairs.
We did win things.
Yeah. And, you know, Jimmy Chi, Brand New Day, Ujuru, Song of a New Dawn Breaking. Like, you know, there was this sense of hope at that time.
Yeah.
And then the pendulum swung too far and things just, changed significantly. And what I learned was that it didn't matter how good we were, because it wasn't about us. Racial violence that we encounter is not because we did something wrong, or that we weren't good enough. So fuck hope for me is giving up that idea that if we're just superhuman, this place that dehumanizes us will suddenly recognize our humanity.
Yeah. People come to me to consult with them just like, you know, what do you people want and that sort of stuff. And I like the way that you discuss like dignity and being still in ourselves and, you know, the aspiration of those things. Like we go through so much surviving in this in this world and through racism and growing up within it. And so just like this idea of like, what is the one thing that you want that's going to solve everything or something like that? We didn't even come here to ask you. If you had been through our history, why would we come here to ask you for anything? So this idea of like Black protests and that it's this noise over here and that sort of stuff to me, or the campaigning that we do, sometimes there's a lot about our own communities and also how we are together. And so I think that I find a really hard thing to explain to people, and then just like, you know, how do we, because they always want to consult me around how we advance different things. I'm like, oh, if you're asking me about that, then I don't have it to give you. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think the other thing when I talk about retiring hope is that typically we have mob who have put so much hope in white institutions.
Yeah.
Who go to institutions believing that they can change it because they bring their knowledge and love for community. And I've just seen too many Blackfellas brutalized by those institutions and betrayed by hope.
Yeah, I like the throughout the story, you do a lot of stories with you and like kind of you're going back through academic processes and Larissa as well, Larissa Brent, Deadly her. Woman. And when we met each other, we're just like, we're both called Larissa. And we like all our commonalities. And we're very skeptical of other people and all this sort of thing. Like, she's a deadly woman.
Oh, we love her.
But also the ability of like, you know, I love the stories and the reminders throughout the book that you write. And just like, I'm not going to do those things. I'm not going to explain those things because why are we doing that? And I think that when you talk about losing faith in white institutions, we've been sold this lie for decades about this is going to be the savior. If we act like this, we will get something. And what I see when I'm like out working with mob across the country is just that people are like, you lied. That didn't come to fruition. So we're just doing
it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's what our people have done. You know, yeah. It's returning to remembering who we are and where we come from. I'd have to have people who come to me and say they're dealing with racism and they want like some reading material or some evidence to take to the institute, you know, in the midst of the fight. Yeah. And I'm like, you don't need to read anything. It's in your turning up.
Yeah.
How are you turning up? Are you demanding or are you begging?
Yeah.
Retiring hope isn't about having nothing. It's about using a different strategy and one that foregrounds our sovereignty.
Yeah.
And that means also then winning means something different. And that's what Auntie Dr. Lilla Watson gave me the gift of reimagining what it is to win.
Yeah.
Because I was in the middle of the race discrimination case against UQ and I'm like, I'm going to win. And because I would have won the case, just to be clear. It was a good case. And I was there and I'm like sitting there at the table going, yeah, I'm going to win this. And she's like, what do you mean by winning? And really forced me to rethink that because I'd still, even in my resistance against racism, had still subscribed to the idea that it would be remedied through their verdicts. And that led me to rethink it and I walked away from the case while we're at Industrial Relations Commission when I could have progressed it. But I talk about how I won and I won on my own terms because the funny thing was all the things that I was asking for in that process – I'd actually got all of those things but not through that process. And so when we have faith in our own people, remember who we come from, we realise that our people are looking after us.
Yeah.
And giving us things. And too often we're looking to white institutions and not returning to our own people.
Yeah, I think I found that when I moved into working in from black organisations and working, being within black community, growing up in my community and that sort of stuff into this what we call or coin the progressive movement. And I just remember like that was the first time I had presented to me like the statistics of who we were and that we were this sorry group of people. And I was like, that's
saddest, sickest.
Yeah. And I found it really confronting and just like I didn't actually know how to explain. It took me a little while and I got really angry. I'm like, you know, the idea that people were othering us in that way and we had different people like, oh, come in and be like, well, this is our criteria for working with Aboriginal
community. The check boxes of how you're going to work with a community. Oh my god.
Oh wow. What a manual.
I've been presented with check boxes by white fellas. Be like, this is how you do it. I'm like, this is the yarn that my 19-year-old self desperately, desperately needed to have. You know, like I was definitely like had the like smoke blown up my ass in like primary school and high school of like, you're a woman as well, so you've got to be 15 times as good. And like when I started moving into this kind of work and campaigning work, I worked in a big white institution where I was the only black fella and the first one in 20 years.
First of a tribe.
Mm-hmm. And I tried and I really tried and I was like, just fucking broke me, right? Like this is the yarn that my like kid me needed to hear because I was like, no, if I'm just like really, really, really good, then they'll be like, oh no, maybe we should try it on the blacks. Maybe the blacks are really, really good and we'll hire more and we'll resource it. And it's just like the best thing that I ever did for myself was go fuck this and go, I'm never working in a white institution again without like really strong assurances that there is a team around me and there is a community within that space because if I don't have that collective, I break.
Yeah, you need at least one of the black fella across the table to roll your eyes with when someone says something stupid and racist.
Oh, right.
To survive in those places. It's I've several cases of race discrimination cases in workplaces where it's the one black person in a work environment and just the daily onslaught of commentary. And you have these workers who are broken who are just saying, I just wanted to do my job. I just didn't want the racism.
So we've had the kind of George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, this kind of global reckoning with race is actually happening. It's just actually cool in terms of way consuming that from black perspectives is really awesome. But people, you know, in the progressive movement come up to me like, oh, they've just realised that their organisation is very white. Like, how do we hire Aboriginal people and all this sort of stuff? And I'm like, if you aren't going to hire more than one, don't hire none.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because we cannot survive in these institutions. And I think that's what I come back to. The other thing I want to segue to talking about is January 26th. Mm. It is upon us. It is happening. It is all around us. I think one of the things that I get asked the most around January 26th is like, abolish your date, change your date. what do we want? Like, I used to feel very antagonistic about it and being like, who cares?
Yeah.
What does it matter?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I'm in the I don't care anymore. I don't think it matters whether it's changed or abolished or it stays the same, really. I think 26th of January has a meaning for blackfellas, a particular kind of meaning, and I hate what the day represents, but I tell you what, I enjoy the day turning up to a rally and marching with mob and ending up at Musgrave Park. I love the fact that before my kids start the school year, ringing in their heads is still here.
Yeah.
Always was, always will, because the next week they got to go to school and talk about settlement and what did you do on Australia Day and deal with the daily commentary in the history curriculum that lies about who they are. And so for me it's like, well, this is an important start to the year for all of us.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the lead up to it's painful, traumatic. You know, blackfellas will get off social media, and if we don't, then we have a fallout with a high school friend or a – you know, racist auntie so-and-so over, you know, all that money on Indigenous affairs, the usual kind of debates that kind of spark around that time. You know, so it isn't a fun time in the lead up to it. And, you know, and then we get the demands on us to again explain again what might be problematic about having this Nation's Day of celebration on the 26th of January, as if they don't know.
That's problematic.
They don't know what's wrong with it. So I enjoy the day with mob and just seeing, like, you know, here in Mianjin.
Which is the best celebration.
Hello.
It is. It's pretty good.
Edie came for the first time last year.
And just to see, you know, the lines getting longer.
Yeah.
The screams are getting louder. And I remember like 14 years ago, I think Maya would have been about two, it was a very small march. And I had the little kids, so I'd just go to Musgrave, and it was more of a morning thing, remember, at the hall?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a very small thing, right?
Not many people.
It was a very small gathering. And to see 14 years later, even in that time, that bridge – and the people film it, the moving across that bridge. And I remember early days, like I'm auntie. Yeah. I remember, like, this is not long ago, it's like only like a few years ago. You used to walk through those streets and all the pubs would be open and all the Australian flags would be hanging out and you'd have all the drunks kind of looking at us like we're stupid. Now the city's closed.
It's closed.
It's shut down.
We were talking about, and I think this is the thing about January 26th and how we, like, that day and how we bring our families and communities together. It's such an incredible day. Yes, there's anger and there's tears and there's, you know, there's truth telling, but there's also a lot of love. Just like being together with people. And I think that for me, no one does it like we do it up here. But I also feel
Brisbane
like
Blacks.
Yeah, Brisbane Blacks. But that's a collective, you know, even as young people, like the Watson family, such an instrumental family of bringing in young black followers and activists, like, you know, rest in peace, Uncle Ross. But, you know, when I first moved up here, I was sleeping on his couch and stuff like that. And that's, you know, turning up to protests for, you know, Palm Island when I was just like, I need to do something. And then there was these black fellas like randomly there. And I was like, I met Uncle Sam and all them and just a bunch of the Watsons back then. But it was just like, I was outraged about this thing. I was like, you meet these people like, oh, this is my family. Do you know what I mean? It's really cool. But I think that for me, the thing on January 26th is and how we are together. A lot of people talk about, you know, what we're protesting for and the moment of coming together and truth telling. And I think this is like, the government has just put millions and millions of dollars into kind of this nationalistic campaign and that sort of stuff. And it's like, that's not going to do anything to the level of protest. But what I'm going to say is like, you know, like, I think it was like 5 years ago and something like that. Like, I remember, I know I should tell this story, but I remember like 5 years ago, like they used to have South Bank like all locked off and hundreds of police there. And this one time we like ran around the back over the Goodwill Bridge and then we're like, we're going to sneak in here. We're going to pull the fence down. So we're going to march through their little celebration, whatever. And we just like, so we went in there, we hid and we're like laying on the ground, all of us young ones. And then everyone was coming over the bridge. And then there was like, we were just like, yeah, let's pull the fence. And there's like 150 cops worked there. And we're like, oh no, sit down. And then like, I think it was like Uncle Sam and Uncle Coke had to be like, wait, no, let them out. It's like us and cops. Like,
I remember that you were all standing there. What, like,
what's going to happen?
And the funny thing is, because I don't think the fences are there anymore.
No, there's nothing at South Bank anymore.
There's no one really at that fake beach anymore. And I don't see it as a sign of progress that the settlers are suddenly, you know, no longer have pride in genocide.
I think our event's just better.
It's just a better and mob are turning up and kids and you know, there is, you know, the rally is a time where mob get to speak and we speak about The ongoing colonial violence, you know, the tragedy that every year there's a new list of names to add to our dead who died prematurely at the hands of the state. And yet at the same time, there is this coming together and feeling strong about being together as a people. If you think about how blackfellas commemorate the 26th of January, there is a real sense of modelling what it is to be truly proud of your people and your nation.
Yeah.
And it's something that maybe them settlers might want to learn about, but
never mind. Yeah. I often talk about different white people and how they come to the protests and that sort of stuff, and just like it's like they're in, like there's a community there, and it's like all of a sudden like they come because, you know, they need their work, gold star, whatever. And then when they get there and keep coming back and that sort of stuff, it's like, oh, there's actually a community here.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always been here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's like people really come and bring their families because of that. But yep. To me, it's like all the blackfellas like from up north, like people drive up from Moree last time and there's a big bus that came through and stuff like that. But I think that, yeah, January 26th and how much it has grown over since the 40th anniversary of Tenancy. We're going to be down at the Tenancy, our next podcast, talking to people. But there was a moment where, you know, when Jonathan made that stupid comment around, like, what are they even protesting for anymore? And then Julia Gillard lost her shoe. Always have this moment of like Aunty Barbara just, like, holding up the shoe and trying to give it back to her. It just makes me laugh in the moment. But, you know, from that, they sparked, you know, there was a call out to start embassies right across the country. And, you know, the idea that the intervention had silenced us and our community was shamed. And so the idea of bringing us back together wasn't about telling the press of the story. It was like, let's go back out to our communities and bring our communities together on this day.
And the other silencing that I think in the post-ATSIC moment too is the silencing that comes through the funding of the health and social services sector.
Yeah.
So of the few, you know, black community-controlled organisations we have, the state has made in such a way that any sense of black activism and advocacy is all but silenced. And so we don't have even community control in the way in which it was originally conceived structurally. So, you know, black communities are trying to find innovative ways to rebuild.
And establish that.
Against this ongoing onslaught from the state of continuing to disperse us and silence us. And this is the ongoing nature of settler colonialism that people don't realise. And I think that there's this, I think some people get a sense that more blackfellas enter into the middle class, that somehow that's a sign of progress. It's a measure of you know, that things have changed, and it's not.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Uncle Gary Foley, one of the, like, main things that he used to say to me when I was in Melbourne and I studied under him at uni and that sort of stuff was, like, beware the middle-class black. That's not who you want to be, because that's not your liberation.
The middle-class, middle-ground black.
That's not liberation, that's assimilation. And I was like, oh, and I didn't fully get it because, again, child. And now I'm a little bit older and, like, significantly crustier. I'm like, oh my God, yes, beware the middle class black. That's not who you want to be.
And you know, and look who's writing about middle class.
Yeah, we know.
Uncle Stan. Your uncle there.
No, that's Edie's uncle.
Hey, shut up. But I think this sort of black middle class thing, it's seductive and sedating.
Yeah.
So people don't want to lose that sense or lose that job and those kinds of things. So therefore stay quiet. But for younger fellas thinking that entering the middle class is making it.
It's aspirational.
Is the goal. That cannot be the measure of our worth as a people. It never has been.
No.
There is such pervasive discourses operating on the minds of our young people. And they're not going to a school where they're all with blackfellas, and they're not necessarily growing up in a suburb or with blackfellas anymore. So all the noise that they hear, whether it's TV or when they leave home, when they go to work, it's whiteness. And there's a violence to being surrounded by that all the time, because you come to believe the lies that are told about yourself. That's why, you know, you get to read Fair Skin Identity piece articles. You know, like, our mob then start pandering to white agendas and white aspirations, and are just so disconnected from our communities, our experiences, our aspirations, and our strength and our power.
Yeah.
And they miss all that.
I think that's, for me, when we protest on any protest that we do, where we bring our families together and that sort of stuff. I knew when we were doing the big forced closures ones and organising that in Mianjin and that sort of stuff. And, you know, everyone around the country was setting different dates, and we were just like, we're going to set it on this date because we know we're going to have a lot of families coming in on this date and that sort of stuff. And I think actually holding that space for the younger generation coming through, to me, that's the most important thing, is the young kids up the front of the rally that are walking and marching the streets and saying these things. And being with, you know, their family and our community and that sort of stuff. And, like, you know, my little nieces and nephews have been looking after them a lot, but they were talking to me about it, like, you know, they've been at school and how they, you know, going back and questioning teachers when they're talking about Captain Cook and stuff like that, or just telling them stories about themselves that aren't true.
Yeah.
And yep. having the strength and the courage to be like, that's not who I am.
Yep.
And that's so important in identity and who we are. And I think keeping and protecting our mom and protecting our families as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember there was a rally a couple of years ago, and it was a nighttime midweek rally. And it was the following week at assembly, my second child decided to refuse to stand for the anthem.
Oh, I remember this,
and
yeah.
And ever since, they get escorted out every week because they're not allowed to sit there. They have to then be removed from the hall. I feel like I've done a good job as a black parent, that child felt strong enough to do that at that age and to be the only kid that does it. And for me with my kids, I want them to go on their learning journey. And, you know, I try and sort of encourage them to do some things, but I'm conscious not to impose upon them how I want them to come to see for themselves and not go, well, you can't do this and you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I want them to come to that learning themselves because you can't tell them anyway when they're teenagers. They don't listen. And so I just love that they got that strength. And then just last year when they went to run for school captain and declared their gender and sexuality in a school that's very violent, when it's so homophobic, and they were able to stand there and say who they were, knowing that it's a really unsafe place. And one of the lines in the speech was, they said, I know who I am and I know what I stand for.
Yeah.
And they only would have got that through turning up with mum to these yeah. rallies and seeing it in action, you know, watching Ruby.
Yeah.
Watching staunch black fellas just turn up in their being and to draw strength and power from that. And I think that's what we don't realize, that protests are not about being angry. It's about our power.
Yeah.
It's about our strength. And it's like sitting in church, bless, at rallies, just sitting yeah. in and just taking it in and thinking about the theorizing that's going on in those moments where people are just speaking from that place. It's such a gift that we have, and I think people are missing out on hearing some of our nation's leading thinkers by not turning up to these places.
Yeah, my little niece Stella was telling me the other week when she's over, she's like, yeah, we're going to go to that, what's that thing called? A protest. We're going to get it. We're going to go to this politics thing. Mm-mm. And then she's explaining it to her brother, and she was saying, like, yeah, it's where we just run around the streets yelling around and police can't do nothing. Which is just funny. But
isn't this the Stop It Parade?
Yeah, she called it the Stop It Parade. Hey. where are you going to be this January 26th?
Okay, so this January 26th, I'm going to be down at Coolangatta. It'll be a Yugambeh country, being on the NITV Sunrise Ceremony panel.
Oh, that was deadly last year.
Okay, well, hopefully deadly this year.
Yeah.
So I'll be down there on that panel and seeing how I go, cruise back and maybe probably make it to Musgrave. I'm not sure I'll make it in time for the rally by the time I get back. But
we'll be going at Musgrave.
We'll be, yeah, heading over there and grabbing the kids.
Thank you so much for being here, our first guest on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's deadly to have you on. Edie, what's coming up?
So next week we'll be live at the 10 Embassy. You might have seen that there's been some shenanigans going on there. We don't want to think about that.
Someone
what we're
down
talking
Portico.
About is the 50th anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, mm-mm. which is on January 26th, talking to family members and community members who've kept that fire burning for the last 50 years. For those of you who don't know, the Tent Embassy, pretty bloody important, big history, big legacy, big fights for land rights and for our mob. So we'll be down there next week.
Check out our podcast, Talk Black, talkblack.org.au. Thank you so much, Chelsea, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome.
That was fun, yeah.